I'm Anthony Teasdale from the Europaeum, and with me this afternoon is Andrew Graham, who recently became chair of the trustees of the Europaeum. So I wanted to ask Andrew, how did you first become involved in the organisation?
Well, as you know, Anthony, I was been in Oxford for quite a long time, and I was a tutorial fellow in economics in Balliol College. And then I became the master of the college, and the person who'd been the master before me, who went on to become vice-chancellor, had been leading the Oxford end of the Europaeum, and he said, would I take it over? So that was my first involvement. My second involvement stepped up a bit when the subsequent vice-chancellor was going to be chairing the Academic Council, and he couldn't do it, and he asked me to stand in. And so I then, in fact, became the regular chair of the Academic Council. But a much deeper involvement happened a good many years later. It was partly around the time of Brexit, but it was also to do with the change in the tone in Europe. There was a huge growth in populism. And the Europaeum at the time was having a bit of a problem. Our finances weren't quite as strong as they needed to be. And I felt that we needed a bit of new oomph. And I was incredibly lucky. We started a new programme called the Europaeum Scholars Programme. And this absolutely chimed with what the other universities were thinking, which was, it was time for those members in university, whether they're senior members or particularly students, to engage academia with the wider society. And so we started the Scholars Programme in 2017-18. And that has given us new energy, and we've grown the membership. As you kindly said, I've just become the chair of the trustees. And I suppose, in a way, this is stage three. I mean, you know, Trump is making all of us think again. And it's a challenge, and I'm sure we'll rise to it. But I think the need for, in the world of fake news, I mean, what do universities stand for? They stand for reason and evidence. And there couldn't possibly be a better moment for a group of the top universities in Europe to be engaging with the policy world, which is where we've gone.
And now, you mentioned that one of the roles of the Europaeum is to encourage a kind of stronger interface between the worlds of academia and practice. What are the other sort of defining features, as you see it, of the Europaeum's philosophy and the added value which it brings to higher education cooperation in Europe?
Let me put that in two ways, Anthony. I think, first of all, we are explicitly a student-facing organisation. There are other organisations that bring together academics or are lobbying organisations like LERU. We are student-focused. That's very distinctive. But the thing that we have become more and more conscious of is if you start to talk about policy, it just has to be multidisciplinary. Problems don't come as in economics or law or medicine. They're multifaceted. And we've built that into the Europaeum Scholars Programme in a very particular way, because we select about 30 or so students every other year, and then we put them into four teams. And we say to the teams, we're going to give you a set of lectures, talks, etc., to stimulate you. But 2 years from now, each team of 10 or so people, or 8 or so people, has got to come up with a policy or policies that would make Europe a better place. So suddenly, they're looking forwards at policy, they're working outside their discipline, and they're working in teams. And this is a wholly different mode of operation and thinking than they've been doing in their doctorates, and they're finding it very exciting.
I mean, do you think that one of the problems of higher education today is a tendency towards excessive specialisation and silo kind of mentality and approach? Or is that just inherent in higher education, particularly in research? And how does the Europaeum fit in, as it were, to that dimension and that dynamic?
I think that looking at it over the very long run, one would just have to say that the pressure, particularly at the research end, is to go in a more and more specialised direction. I mean, at the beginning of time, everything was philosophy. or everything was religion, one or the other. And then gradually things were spun out from that. But I think that very spinning out, that very centrifugal tendency, every so often gets disrupted because somebody moves from one discipline to another and makes a breakthrough. Keynes was a top mathematician before he became an economist. Other people have been great historians and then moved into some other field. And so I think there's a kind of energy in the academic world that every so often means the disciplines collide. I mean, look at what's happening now with artificial intelligence. Or look at the way in which we now talk about bioengineering. We didn't do that a few years ago. So I think that there is the pressure towards specialization, but there's incredible strength in the connections. And I think that, to repeat myself, once you get into the policy world, it's absolutely essential to make those connections. And I think that one of the things that's really struck me is that as the scholars get engaged in this, they find it every bit as intellectually stimulating and every bit as difficult, if not more difficult, to operate in two or three disciplines as it is in one. So this isn't a sort of down market stuff. This is absolutely cutting edge.
And what is it that you'd most like to achieve during your time as chair? I mean, obviously we have a new kind of innovation agenda at the heart of what the Europaeum's doing. We're developing our alumni dimension. We're going to try and make the Europaeum a rather sharper organisation in terms of its visibility and its public imprint. We're embracing digital technology. We're finding a wider range of outreach partners and so on. But what would you like to be the distinctive achievement of your own time as chair of the trustees?
Well, before I answer that, Annie, let me just give credit and say that I'm very fortunate to have become the chair just when you, Anthony, have become the new, so to speak, CEO. And indeed, I'm looking forward greatly to working with you on some of these innovations. I think that there are, from my perspective, this is not necessarily top priority, but extremely important, is the one that you've mentioned. We need to be much better known. I mean, I imagine in 120 years ago, the Rhodes Scholarships weren't very well known. But 20 or 30 years from now, the Europaeum scholars should be equally well known. Point number two, we have only just recently begun to get going what I think will be a very exciting alumni leadership and policy program. We bring people back together. Having worked together as scholars or in other Europaeum events, these people know each other and trust each other. And I think we'd bring them back because they like meeting each other, but the core point would not be to engage in nostalgia, but to continue to think about the problems of Europe. So I think that's very exciting. And then, I mean, you know, the absolutely wonderful thing would be if one of the policy ideas that came out of our scholars project was a real breaker in some way. I mean, somebody at some point in time must have dreamt up the joint stock company, you know, transformed capitalism. Maybe capitalism's in for a bit of a rethink. People are a bit fed up with it. So some ideas, if two or three really good ideas came out, and on the back of that, if we attracted a good deal more funding, everybody needs money, I wouldn't be upset with being better known, good ideas, better funding.
And the Europaeum has, of course, two sources of funding. One is the subscriptions that we get from member universities, and the other is charitable donations that we get from foundations, organisations, individuals of various kinds. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the first of those two, which is the scale of the Europaeum in terms of the number of organisations. I mean, we currently have 17 members. We have a plan to bring that up to around 20 over the next year or two. I mean, what do you think is the optimal sort of weight, if you like, in terms of membership? And how should the Europaeum go about deciding which universities to approach as it gradually expands?
On the numbers, I don't have any golden figure fixed, but I do think that to retain a kind of sense of the body being connected, 20 is a very good target. I can see it going up a bit above that, but not a great deal above that. And even going up from 17 to 20 makes quite a difference to the financial structure. On the question of which universities, it's worth going back to the beginning when Oxford University first established this. It's thought of connecting with the great universities of Europe. So Sorbonne, Bologna, Leiden, these were the great traditional strong universities. And I think that we've always worked with the idea that we wanted to have either the best or one of the best universities in all the main European countries. And that once you get to 20, okay, the EU is bigger than that, Europe is bigger still, but at 20 or so, you're getting quite a good spread. And the membership, you and I have occasionally talked, there is a huge misunderstanding about the word elite. People sometimes use it and think that, you know, Oxford's an elite university or the Sorbonne's an elite university. But nobody minds being in an elite football team. We want these to be the top universities, the best, and so we want the best students. And that's the criteria.
And does that help explain the emphasis which you've already placed in what you said a bit earlier on leadership and policy, which you feel is some sort of deficit in these two areas at the moment in terms of the output of higher education and in terms of the philosophy of higher education?
It's a very deep question, and I'm pausing. I mean, you'd have to say, slightly regrettably, that I don't think the policy pursued by some of the countries, I'm thinking of my own, particularly the UK, which has been actually very heavily influenced by people from Oxford, has been all that brilliant. But that might be because we didn't think of that as being something we wanted to teach people. They went off and studied classics in great depth, or history in great depth, or more increasingly these days, maths, physics, science in great depth. But they weren't introduced to the complexity of what it's like to try and make this stuff in the real world. I mean, I was talking to a former colleague of mine just last night who went off to, a very good physicist, he went off to run CERN. And he said the move from doing physics to running people was something that he massively underestimated how difficult it would be. And I think that we in the European Union are making a very distinctive contribution, because one of the things that our doctoral students learn is that they've got to work with their group. And it's this interaction is how you get policy done and then how you persuade people in the rest of the world to follow you.
And I mean, you've been involved both in academia and in public policy now for six decades of your adult life. If you had to pinpoint one particular achievement, what would you say that was, the one thing you'd most like to be remembered for? And then arrive at that, what's the task that you've undertaken during that period which you found the most difficult and the most challenging, and which in a way you feel proudest of having turned around?
I would really like to have two, Anthony. And they were challenging in completely different ways, both quite scary. I mean, getting the European Scholars Programme off the ground was enormously satisfying, and it went right down to the wire. There was one Friday. We didn't have the money until 10 days before. We hadn't got the agreement of the universities. We hadn't announced anything, and suddenly on that Friday, everything came into place. Phew, that was worrying. And now it's up and doing extremely well, and people love it. The other one, when I was Master of Balliol, I founded the Oxford Internet Institute. And that was scary in two respects, which was that the wonderful donor, Dame Stephanie Shirley, who gave us the money, insisted that everything be in place before anything was said in public. And at the time when I first had the meeting with her, Balliol College, which was going to be involved, the University of Oxford was going to be involved, and the government was going to be involved. None of these knew anything about it whatsoever. So I came out of my meeting with her with my adrenaline going flat out and pretty terrified about what I'd committed myself to, but they both worked. And I think you have to risk a bit to make things happen.
And I mean, what would you now say to either to your younger self, if you knew, you know, how your life had unfolded, or to a young scholar who came to you and asked for advice about things to think about and know about as one embarks on the great adventure of life?
I would say two things which might seem contradictory. One is, if somebody offers you a job which sounds interesting and you think you can't do it, that's the job to take. It'll stretch you more than anything else. That was what it felt like when I became a tutorial fellow in economics at Baylor. It was beyond my imagination, but I somehow managed to do it. And the other bit of advice, going exactly in the opposite direction, and when I first heard it, I didn't want to hear it. It was coming from my wife, Peggotty, and she said, "Andrew, you need to take a break." And she was absolutely right in two different senses. One is, I was very tired, and we all need to look after ourselves in order to find the new energy. But it's not just the new energy, it's the new creativity that comes from the break. I mean, just the other day I was reading about Thomas Edison, and he had a great inventor. And what he used to do was, he used to take a lot of catnaps. But as he started a catnap, he'd hold a glass in his hand. And when he fell asleep, the glass would drop and wake him up. And just in that brief moment, relaxation was had, when he had some of his best ideas. So I think young people should push hard, but also take a pause, find the creative moment. And I hope we in the European continue to do that.
What great advice. And let's all take that to heart. This is the latest of our short European interviews and conversations. Thank you very much, Andrew, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Anthony.